This is tape two of the interview with Guy Orkut.
So we had this, Arnold was the thing that came up while I was still here. We had also an experience in trying to hire another recent economist, Reese, who from Chicago, who we wanted to bring. And he and then turned us down, and in turning us down, spoke about what he regarded as inadequate future of it. And it was seemed to us quite clear he did not choose to come because he did not come to believe it had the future we hoped. And I think this reflected, I don't know what, but in any case, from internally, it was a little hard because it wasn't clear to us it had the future either. So while, of course, we tried to sell the future, you couldn't quite sell it with the same enthusiasm when you began to doubt it. And in my personal case, it began to affect me quite substantially. I got to be worrying about the effect it was having on me and what I thought of as my ability to be an effective teacher or to be an effective researcher. I don't know if it had any. I mean, I'm not quite sure. Other people never seemed to notice. But it did seem to be bothering my speech to me.
And because you were worrying.
Yes, I worried a lot. It got to be harder and harder for me to think about what the future held, because what I didn't want to be and what it seemed to me I was clearly going to be unless I did something was I didn't want to be a fundraiser and administrator and that be my primary role for the rest of my life. I always liked the people here and I liked the university and I always did when I left. But this business of having 20 grants, which only worked because you had four or five good center directors who could basically mobilize them. And the reason they could mobilize them was because when you want to get the money from places like NSF, which was always very good to us, or the Ford Foundation and some other places, or OEO we got some money from, it's always good if you can have the person who's going to be the key person in, from a research standpoint, who's the one who's actively engaged in trying to get the grant. It's very difficult to be a fundraiser and get funds for things in which you're not going to actually, you don't have the dream yourself, or I mean, whatever it is. So the reason they could be, or we collectively could be so effective, was because the people who basically were going to do it, be the key actors in each of these, were these center directors. And so if they couldn't have that, what they all felt, we all felt, and I felt it maybe more than they did with respect to our staff, we began to have quite a number of people we had hired and which we thought we needed. But and we paid for them out of the soft money. But then the notion was, something will go wrong. I mean, inevitably, you can't plan it so it doesn't. And you got to have some leeway to pick up on these things which don't work. And then there are things you need which the funder doesn't want to support. They don't want to support a lot of things which we might regard as essential. We couldn't run the kind of operation we were running or wanting to run, without people we wanted to think of as in a long-run position, reasonably long-run. By long-run, we didn't mean life tenure. We meant having more than 2 or 3 months' notice, which we had people within the computing area, which programmers and so on, which we needed badly to use these machines if we were going to use them effectively, which really had no protection. It became clear to me that seeing how the university would run on a state, if you weren't on the budget, and the university hadn't accepted responsibility for you, you didn't have any protection for, I don't know how long we thought it was needed then, but you certainly wouldn't have had it for 6 months. Yeah. And this thing began getting to me as to my personal responsibility and my feeling of obligation to these people. These all people, of course, they have families and have things, and you begin to care about what their situation will be if you now come up short And you want to tell them that you can't, you just have to throw them out. And many of them kind of shared in some kind of, you might say, a joint dream. Well, of course, we have people like Alice Wilcox, and before her, Anna Campbell, who was an enormous support of, in terms of people that are on, headed up our, you might say, our secretarial group, and was very important to lots of people here. Both these women are, and there would have been other people and programmers that were really quite important. Jack Behrens, who was here, was, they had no future except through our organization. So this began to worry me, and then the question is also the view I would have of my own role. I'd always wanted to be, I wanted to be in a research organization. I wanted to be basically doing research that I thought was socially relevant. I wanted to have something that would make a close the thing between, you might say, basic research, which is what I thought was needed, and having some relevance in terms of governmental operations, in terms of at least giving some guidance about what the consequences of actions a government takes are likely to be, and rather than just short-run forecasting or so on. I wanted to have some insight about the consequences of the things we do or what they might be. And I think it does take basic research, and it takes microdata, and it takes sustained effort. And I didn't see how this was going to be maintained. And I didn't see, because some of this is not attractive. It wasn't attractive to the funding, the people on soft funds. You don't get soft funds for things that are too far removed, at least from what seemed like some kind of a payoff. Some of the things that we had undertaken were quite long run in the horizon. One I'll mention in particular, which did go on, it was at some great personal cost, I think, to the people involved, had to do with the data collection effort, which Bob Lantman had been quite helpful in starting, and Martin David and Roger Miller actually carried out. And I think for a period in their career, it was very difficult for them. And that involved taking the state tax returns from the state of Wisconsin. And it turned out that we figured out a way in which you could turn those into a longitudinal file. We thought we needed longitudinal data about microentities. There's been very little of that. And with the help of people that had been related to Harold Grove, who had gone and become secretary, state treasurer, I think, if I'm right, state treasurer, who had the responsibility for these tax returns which the state had collected. The state had collected them. They had stored them in four different places around the state. They had collected them over a number of years. They still had them, but they weren't filed so you had the sequential record for anybody. Mm-hmm. They were filed by year. We figured out what we thought was an imaginative way in which we could get a sequential file for individuals. That is, and it involved, I thought, quite a lot of nice ideas about how we could do sampling by name groups so that in the end we could actually get samples. We'd sample every file on a name basis so that we would have 50 name groups in which we would have the same names. And then we would match them by actually observing in detail what is on the ones so we would be sure we could have the same persons. And we'd try and follow when you had wives change their names and splits and so on. Well, it was a pretty big thing, and in terms of the effort involved. And we arranged, because of the cooperation which we could get in terms of a belief we could keep it confidential in terms of not disclose individual things about people, and this depended upon the connections with people like Harold Groves had and Bob Lantman. And we thought this was important to have for a variety of good reasons. And so the state treasurer did, in fact, allow us to we got some microfilm equipment of the appropriate kind, and go in and microfilm the returns, photograph the returns incompletely of these individuals and link them. Well, this took years of work, and much more than, and almost was a finish, I'm sure, of Roger and at one point maybe Martin, in terms of not being adequately funded, because our funding really, we didn't have adequate funding, and it took more work than we originally thought. Any case, that's a kind of a thing which takes some kind of duration, as any kind of data collection does, and the social sciences simply aren't geared up to get the data they need for their own research. So you don't have much in the social sciences. Maybe in psychology you do, but in where they have some experimentation and so on. But in the rest of them, they depend basically on somehow getting the data from some kind of records or from some kind of surveying. Some of us had pushed quite hard before I came to Wisconsin and continued to get the Survey Research Center at the University of Michigan to collect longitudinal data. And Tobin and I had been on a committee which had done that along, gotten them to, we weren't, and they had in fact got the University of Michigan to be, the Federal Reserve Board had sponsored it, as they had helped finance the survey operation in Michigan, and they had, with some encouragement and a willingness on the end of the Michigan end, to begin making the data they collected not regarded as just the property of the collector, but also a national resource, and to get them to move towards doing longitudinal surveying, which they then have done on a grand scale since then. Yeah. But these kind of things are things which they require a horizon, which you've got to think in terms of 5-10 years at the minimum, and you've got to think about somehow staffing and maintaining those things. And it does take some kind of, you have to have some kind of structure to do it. Well, so then when it became clear that we weren't going to have it, I couldn't see how we were going to get it, it did, as I say, began bothering me a great deal.
I'd like to put in a question here. How much did the departure of the Center for Demography and Human Ecology, how did that affect you?
That didn't depart till we had already begun to disintegrate.
Oh.
That was afterwards. At the time when I'm talking about, it was still very much. Norman Ryder was mm-hmm. here, and it was still one of our six centers. And it didn't begin to be a separate entity. We had helped found it, and mm-hmm. Norman was quite active in it. No, it was that spreading, that losing it, that was after I left.
Oh, I see. I thought it was earlier.
Well, if it was, my memory has gone playing tricks. But I don't remember that as being at all critical. I think of it as a consequence of what caused my leaving. And mm-hmm. I think of it as coming out of the same things which, it's splitting off, coming out of the same things which caused me to leave.
Yeah, I see.
Rather than in any sense being a cause of it was no factor at all in my leaving, that I could say for sure, because I'm sure of that. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't recognized that it was being split off at the time when I had thought I was leaving. Now, when I first decided I was going to leave, probably, it was actually before I left, I thought we got to the time of the summer of 64. We got to the calendar year, the academic year, 64-65.
When you came, you thought you were expecting to stay
permanently. Yes.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. I gave up my Harvard appointment, which I was one of the few mm-hmm. people that have done that.
Yeah, bet,
and I got lots of suggestions about that. And as a fact is, after I came, just to say something about that, after I'd been here about 3 years, I came in 58. One of my friends from Harvard said, wouldn't you like to come back? Actually, you'd have to be wanted back if you were going to come back, because when I left Harvard, you do resign. Mm-hmm. So I had no longer had it. I didn't come on leave.
Yeah.
I did resign. And after I'd been here about 3 years, my friend, lifelong friend still is, Jim Dusenberry, who had been classmates and actually shared quarters at Michigan, and been colleagues at MIT, and also he had joined me for a while when I was in the Department of Applied Economics in Cambridge, England, after I left MIT on my second job. He said, wouldn't you like to come back? He said, you could, you know. And I said, I couldn't possibly think about that. I said, this thing we're doing here, I fully committed to, and I really wanted to go, and I think I just would be unacceptable in terms of my relations here or in terms of what it was doing for me to come back. I can't remember exactly what I told
him. Did you ever regret that?
Well, I did somewhat regret it. When it got to be about, it was about a year and a half later, and I began to recognize that this problem wasn't, we weren't going to overcome this problem. That's what I decided in terms of this funding. It was going to be hand to mouth. It might go, but I didn't think I had the stomach for it, for that kind of a thing. And I didn't think I was cut out for being successful at that kind of an operation as my, what I was going to do as my career. I wanted to make a career and did then as in terms of my research interests, and I still had this dream of this micronite modeling, and I thought it was going to take at least 10 years to pull off. And in any case, then I was heavily involved, so I turned it down. I mean, which was an opening. I don't know whether it could have been delivered or not, but he thought it could be at that time. I thought it would be, and that I would have been welcomed back in. They did take back subsequent and later years one of my first doctoral students who had gotten tenure at Harvard, John Myers. He'll be at this conference. No, he won't, because it's his grandson just died. Well, he and Ed Koo were my first two doctoral students, and he did give up, and he got an early tenure appointment at Harvard. I tried to move him from Harvard while I was here. I tried to move him not to Wisconsin, but I thought, because I don't think we could have. But I was participated in, there's an Upper Midwest Research Project, which was out of Minnesota, and the person that was in their central, in the Federal Reserve Bank of Minnesota, was chairman of that of committee, which I served on before I came here and after I came here. And they needed a director, and I tried to move him. I tried to make it so it happened that he would move. And he did, in fact, go out there, and he came through Wisconsin, and we had him here. He was very much interested in what we were doing here. In any case, he did move from Harvard subsequently to that, and was went to Yale before I went to Yale, and then subsequently went back to Harvard. But in my own case, I mean, the truth of the matter was, when I was when it got to be 64, 65, I was feeling pretty low. The summer of 64 to me was a very low point, and I thought I ought to do something, but I didn't know what, which was going to change the direction that I was going in. And these are fucking funny to me actually now, but I thought, I better get myself organized so I can do some things. I better learn French. I don't know why I thought French. I thought I would be better able to compete in doing the things I want if at least I knew a foreign language. I had reading knowledge of French and German to get the PhD, but I didn't know how to speak anything. And so I signed up during the summer here for a French course, which was an intensive one. And I still have vivid memories of it because it was you had a young woman who was really very good, but very, very high expectations. And I was the only older person. See, when I came here, I wasn't very young. I was already in my 40s when I came here. And I had hoped I could keep up with this class. The truth of the matter was I couldn't keep up with anybody. And I felt terrible in this class, because I was so obviously the dumbest one in it.
It must have made you feel worse then.
It did. It didn't help at all. I felt like a complete washout by the time I don't know as I even finished it. And my kids used to joke me about their dropout papa at that point. That didn't help any. Any case, and I didn't learn French either. Well, by now, I wish I had, because I have a French daughter-in-law by now. But any case, By the fall, I was feeling pretty low, and it was affecting, I thought it was affecting my speech.
Literally.
Literally affecting, in the sense that I thought I was beginning to affect my speaking in ways which made me uncomfortable, and which may have been completely psychological, I suppose it was, but in any case, I thought there was, in the sense of making me hesitate and be more halting about the speech in ways which was not really conducive to speaking in the style which I was used to speaking, which was always much without much except in the way of very brief notes, and making me begin to feel I needed more written out and more tending to read it, is because of insecurity about the fact that the ideas would come when I wanted them to come, which I'd always thought they would, you know. And but when once you start getting, so I that worried me, and I was teaching at this point here. I taught statistics in a large class, not a real large class. This was a graduate one. You want to change that?
No.
Any case, about this in the fall of that year, chairman at Harvard called me up and said, wouldn't you like to, or maybe Jim Dusenberry called me and said, how would you like to come and spend a year at Harvard as a visiting professor? And they had a nice arrangement, which sounded quite nice. I only teach one class, and I would teach statistics. At that point, you handled all their graduate students in economics in one statistics course. I had taught that when I was at Harvard. That's what I did teach. I taught practically all the graduate students for a while in that. And then I had started an econometrics seminar while I had still been at Harvard, and which it lasted and was still going on, and take that for one semester and have somebody else like John Myers share it with me. So it was a nice kind of an arrangement, which was very pleasant, and I took it, and I really appreciated it a great deal. And I went back, and I taught what was a fairly large class, and what I thought were good students. And I did the seminar, and these were successful, and I thought...
that you were talking all right?
Yeah, I thought, gee, this is good, it looks like I still could teach. Hmm. Good students and be successful in a situation like that. And it did a lot for me, actually, just this realization that I could do it. And then the next interaction with the students was quite successful, and some nice thing came out of it. A couple of students, we subsequently published work together in the econometric seminar, and the whole thing was really quite nice. Now, while I was there, the truth of the matter in terms of whether I could have gone back, I think it gradually emerged. If somebody had said, would you like to come back at this point, I would have said yes. Mm. But instead of that, what happened was I would say 7 or 8 members of that department asked me if I would like to come back, and that indicated to me something that they were effectively the senior faculty meeting, which I wouldn't meet with, of course, since I wasn't a tenure member at that point, that were thinking about it, and these people I thought would probably have supported the idea. But the truth of the matter was nobody ever asked me. Mm. So I never had the option. What I decided was, I thought, well, maybe they'll ask me another time, but they hadn't gotten around to it yet, at least. And they probably, there are some mixed feelings, or probably were, about whether I'm the one that they really want at this point. And they subsequently brought some other good people from Chicago. And Grilkus would be one they brought, which I might have been a substitute for, or might have been instead. So it became apparent over the years that while it might have been debated various times, there always was some opposition. And in the Harvard thing, it doesn't take a lot of opposition because it's almost always by collective agreement. And so one or two people could easily stop something. I thought that probably, I never knew and it doesn't matter, it's not irrelevant to this. I thought probably I had Leontief, whom I had worked with some while I was there, but had stopped working with him after I had been there a few months, and effectively it was developed what was in some sense a competing framework to the input-output structure, which Leontief is known for, that perhaps he was not so keen on my return. I don't know, but it doesn't matter. In any case, I didn't get an opportunity. And so I came back, and during the subsequent next year, I had basically decided I was probably going to leave. What I'm saying is, sometime I decided at about '64, summer of '64, fall of '64, that I had made up my mind I was going to leave. If I could see something, but I didn't know what to. I thought that probably if I stay here at Wisconsin, much as I like the place, I have no future except to be a fundraiser and an administrator. And if I wanted to be a fundraiser and administrator, it would be great, but I don't want to be. And I didn't think I wanted to, I didn't see what the future would hold. I got a call during the, after I came back. I came back here in 65, in the 66, 67 year. I was back here and spent a year here after I was at Harvard. And I, of course, still owned our house here, and I hadn't resigned or anything. And I got a call from an old friend that was at the, I had worked for him after I left Stone's Outfit in England. After 2 years, I wanted to come back to the United States, and I'd gone to the International Monetary Fund. At that time, my friend was there. But in the intervening time, he had gone to the World Bank and become something of what would be the vice presidential level. And we'd stayed friends over the years after I'd worked with him. I'd never met him before, but after I had worked with him, we were friends for life, still are. And he says, why don't you come down to the World Bank and put your, not your foot in your mouth, but put your efforts where your mouth is or something, and see what you could do there. And thought he could provide an opportunity. And so I decided at that point to do that. And we sold our house, and I offered my resignation and intended to move out of academic life. It was also true that for a variety of reasons, academic life seemed somehow less attractive to me. I'm not quite sure why at this point. We hadn't quite got to the nastiest business about the Vietnamese War here. It wasn't nasty. It wasn't because of that. I'm not sure why it was, but maybe I thought I just didn't want to teach anymore for some reason. And so I moved to the World Bank, and I won't just to close that off, because that's not too interesting here. But he got sort of shafted in the change of president of the World Bank to change. And I became less clear that I really wanted to stay at the World Bank. And I got some instructions one time to not send out something which I thought I had every right to send out in respect to what I was doing, which in fact I'd already sent out because it never occurred to me I would have to ask for permission to send out something. And I got a request from Bill Gorham, who was setting up the Urban Institute. He had inquired about me earlier whether I wouldn't come and help him set it up. He was going to set it up, but he thought I might be helpful. And I had said no, I was going to be at the World Bank. But he said, well, if you ever change your mind, give me a ring. And when I got that memo, which I was very offended about, and which was one of a number of things, and I could see how things were going, I thought were going to go there with what was happening to my friend, who became McNamara's one economic advisor for a while, but surely wasn't going to last as that. So I called up Bill Gorham and said I'd like to come, and I did. And so I went to the Urban Institute from the World Bank after about 9 months in the World Bank. While I was at the World Bank, I had already arranged to try and move Charlie Holt down to the World Bank, who has become the director of the Social Systems Research Institute, and I'd brought here, or helped bring here. And he was already in the process of going to do that when this came up. The upshot of it all was that I got him the option of whether he would go to the World Bank or go to the Urban Institute, and he came to the Urban Institute. And then after a while, I moved up to Zero and kept a relationship with the Urban Institute for about 5 years.
On the centers, there was a reorganization of them in I think 1963. As I said, the criticism has been that people didn't really work together. Did you do that in hopes that it would work out better? And are there things now that you would have done differently if you could go back and do it again?
Not that I remember. The thing that you might want to take a look at, or maybe you have taken a look at, Charlie Holt wrote a thing. I don't know if you know this document. That the paper I wrote that you did read is in the back of that along
with the one other, about to the Ford Foundation.
Yes. But there is a big part of this which Charlie Holt wrote, or he with others.
Uh-huh.
And I thought I'd like at least to leave you with a copy of that if you want.
Can I have this for the
I need a copy. I need it back.
Ah.
I mean I thought I'd ask Alice Wilcox yes. or somebody to make a copy.
There may be a copy in the archives. I should I could look into it.
I'd like to keep a copy. I have, but as you see, that one's getting old. And there were lots of copies made, but Charlie Holt will also be here at this meeting.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of our internal structure, I don't have a clear memory of what happened probably at the time you're talking about. The year 64, the year 65, 66, I wasn't actually here.
Well, this was 63, I think.
And before that had happened, we had some change in which I became the director of research rather than the director of the institute. And Charlie Holt became the director of the Social Systems Research Institute.
Yeah, that's what I'm basing my...
I guess I must say my memory is maybe faulty.
Well, it's probably covered in his paper anyway. So
well, what I was going to say about it was that the changes which I think are reflected in this, I think I was very much involved in. But I don't ever remember, I don't have a feeling that we had major problems at that time.
Uh-huh.
I think there is some reflection, there's more reflection on the problems which maybe were to some extent there, which are picked up maybe in Charlie Holt's things, because he, in this particular document, he doesn't talk much at all about finances because I, in fact, have said a fair amount of that in the thing which he included in this.
Mm-hmm.
But he does focus a lot on the organization
mm-hmm.
and in terms of the kind of internal strains and problems which he saw. So he clearly saw them, and I thought in reading it, I wasn't quite so... they weren't so acute in my mind as they were in his mind. Mm-hmm. So it's his statement and not my statement.
Yeah.
But it surely has some basis. And there did seem to me there was a problem, which I might have said one of, not of, the diffuseness of the organization. Our organization, it wasn't quite clear where the boundaries were.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, in my own mind as I think about it now, we were torn between wanting to be all-inclusive and wanting to be focused enough so we had a mission that we could understand and which we could pursue in terms of funding. And there was that kind of a tension, which I'm sure I wasn't quite sure how we should handle it. And I didn't see it so much from the inside of the other departments, but in economics, it was perhaps reasonable to think that the things which, let's say, I wanted were not coextensive with what many faculty members would have wanted in economics. So that we wanted to have a place for other kinds of interest. I never had the notion that what I wanted should be the exclusive interest of the economics department. At the same time, we had gotten the funding and we had gotten the building, and if that funding had been able to be followed through, we clearly had intended to build an organization which was not, we didn't want to dominate the department, but we didn't want the departments to dominate the organization. I'm sure I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to have something which was separate from a departmental structure, which cut across them, which would be hopefully liked by them in terms of thinking of it as their research arm. We didn't aspire to any role in the teaching, aside of the fact that in our work it would be of some help in terms of a graduate program, but we didn't expect to have any kind of a say as an organization in terms of the teaching responsibilities of the department with respect to students. We hope to sort of enhance them with respect to the research opportunities and the seminars which we did organize. We organized quite a lot of seminars, which we people would join in. So I can remember that. Now, in terms of what I also remember, which maybe relates to this, is after we got this new building, it was a little dismaying to me as to then, as we now had this, what is really quite a plum, to see the various interests in terms of use of it. Now, the problem already was accentuated because by the time we got the building actually here, which was getting pretty close to a seat of one I was already going to be leaving or thinking about leaving, was that everybody was interested in having office space in it. We didn't have the resources by which we could actually occupy the space with respect to the things which we'd hoped to occupy it with. As we, in terms of these survey research center, the computing center, we didn't have funds to our own things to give those any security. In terms of when we got the building, with the relationship to the NSF and so on, there had to be resolved questions of how it's going to be administered and how are you going to allocate space and things like that. And I look back a little bit at what's somewhat said in that. I have the original proposals for getting the building that went to NSF, and they're quite thick, about that thick, and they do describe a lot of things. And I looked up to see how it was we were going to allocate space. Well, it says basically that the departmental chairman, there's going to be a committee which was going to have the director of our institute and the chairman of sociology, economics, and I can't remember whether there was one more. There were four people on it, and they were basically supposed to work in a way which would work with unanimity and good spirits. If there was to be some kind of a conflict, then there was some kind of a procedure for rectifying that conflict. What it seemed to involve, as far as my memory right at the moment, is that, well, the dean of the graduate school would join us, and collectively there would now be five of us. We'd work by what was a majority vote in that group, as terms of allocating the space. Mm. Well, then, when we came to actually getting the space, if we had the funds, it would have been more of an issue. But since we didn't have the funds to actually, you might say, physically occupy the space, we had visualized at the time the space building was being built, it was for this institute.
Yeah.
And the whole 8 floors was to be for this institute. That's what the funds were raised for. And it was to include lots of interest of all these departments, include the anthropology group, the sociology group, the economics in particular, but some of the political science and so on. They had all supported getting the building, but by the time we actually got the building so we could move into it, I had hoped to play a less central role in terms of administration, and that had to do with my shifting from being the director to effectively being the research director, which is what I really wanted to put my interest in, and Charlie became the director. And so he had to worry about more of these things. I quit worrying about a lot of those aspects of space allocation and so on, and not quite so much about funding as I had. So he probably got a different perspective than I did, because I didn't actually focus so much on those things.
But you lost the survey research lab. That went elsewhere, and I guess the Poverty Institute came in and occupied.
Oh, yeah, well,
space.
That's what happened during the same period. We got the Poverty Institute, but then it became clear that by the time we got it, it was a different organization. It was going to perform the same mission that it had in mind, but it wasn't to be a piece of us. And since they had the funds, They occupied the space. They occupied a lot of the space because they had the $1 million a year. We didn't have it. And so they brought in, and then they started, of course, using those funds to bring in people. So that was related in that way to my perception of the difficulty, which wasn't that the departments were becoming uncooperative, but was that we weren't able to effectively fulfill what we, our hopes, because we didn't get the funds and we didn't hire the people and we didn't direct now where the thing was going. And also in getting those the funds from OEO, the university made various commitments, which I don't know what they were, but they were asked to make fairly strong commitments to OEO, that how the university was going to back them up, support them, and give them light. Yeah. So the way the university could fulfill those things was basically by using the support which we had hoped to get, and in terms of the physical use of the thing, which was funds we had raised, actually using that. Mm-hmm. And we had no basis for complaining or preventing it, because we didn't have any way of occupying them ourselves. And so what happened was that also, so the building then got used very rapidly for, you might say, departmental members who had the more minimal connection with the Social Systems Research Institute.
Okay. Yes, we actually had started that story and hadn't finished it. it seems that the sociologists never really did work, or that it's been said they weren't really interested in the questions that were being asked. Is that your perception? And did that?
Well, it's not quite my perception, but what they were probably never became as interested in as I would have wished was in the ideas I had. Mm-hmm. That is, the idea of having this interdisciplinary institute with centers and so on, which would cut across departmental lines, I think was attractive to people like Sewell always. Mm-hmm. And I thought probably in terms of Norman Ryder.
But what Leo became. Leo Schnorr at the time.
And Leo Schnorr we used to interact a lot with. And there were others who I don't come to my mind right at the moment, but I'm sure there were. There were several others. But they each had their own interests, as most people do. I mean, even within part of the virtue of the kind of a structure I had visualized, as I came to perceive, was the openness of it, which it had to using people of different talents and different disciplines, as contrasted with what I had been experienced quite a bit, was the Leontief input-output structure, which was very demanding in terms of, you thought of it as a thing in which you have a central conception, but everybody that's working on that is really doing little things which don't have too much interest in themselves. These input-output coefficients are enormously hard to get, but they aren't the kind of thing which are very, it isn't open to you, the kind of bringing expertise and things which you would hope to get from various disciplines. So I had always thought of this as part of the strength of, in terms of research organization, was part of the value of the kind of conception I had of modeling the economy, was its openness to this. But it would still be true that whereas in economics I was moving, and the profession in fact moved partly with me and partly would have done it anyhow, I'm sure, was towards having an interest in micro data and micro analytic modeling. The sociologists moved in just the opposite direction. They came from something which was far more aggregative in terms of their thinking about the system. Not very much quantitative background to it, but in terms of the conceptual structure they started from a position, let's say, my perception of it is, they started from a thing which started more micro, but they were moving towards the macro. The kind of a thing which economists were doing, had been doing, started maybe 10 or 15 years earlier before that point, like Tinbergen in terms of the macro econometric models and Kleins and so on, they were much entranced with, and they were moving from of a focus on micro to a macro, which was more like econometricians, of which I thought of myself as one, had been, rather than the And where I was thinking it was essential for us to move in terms of our econometric works more towards paying attention to the micro database. So they were literally, and I don't think just here, but nationally, mm-hmm. going in a direction which meant that they probably were not so enthusiastic about my ideas. So I didn't interpret their thing as, in some sense, wanting to withdraw from the Institute. But they really meant that we weren't sharing a common vision,
yeah.
and which was I had associated with my what was
yeah.
closely associated with me. I thought it was still quite compatible with what would be our structure of this institute, and I thought of the structure as being hopefully able to develop in a way which could accommodate considerable diversity and not just be thought of as something which was an orchid. Modeling venture. I didn't ever visualize it as that. And so that was true. And along with that, though, the sense in terms of the funding, since the basic funding problem was going to be entirely on the center directors, that meant that they, it did tend to say we were going to get a bunch of structures which are going off in quite different directions.
Yeah.
And that happened. And I do remember the sociologists with respect to the population area, which Norman Ryder was in. I was sympathetic to their work, but it seemed to me to be not going in the direction I would have liked to have seen it gone in. And I was conscious of that. And then in the case of the Survey Research Center, it wasn't going as well as I hoped. I thought that was basically because of funding problems. They lost Al Reese. I don't know for sure why they lost him. That was a loss for the university. Mm-hmm. And so they had some problems in respect to ever mounting that effort with respect to its development in the way which we had hoped. I'm not sure that they were connected with they had to do with funding, I think, a lot of it. But we weren't supplying them any funding support. I mean, from the standpoint of the unit of the Institute.
Oh, dear. Well, they won't be able to get in because, wait.
Oh, gee, I'm sorry.
Without trying to interrupt you, we might give you a chance to have some lunch.
I'll be right with you.
Could we have about 5 minutes or so?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I guess the
other two questions that... I mean, what did you achieve? Have you written it up some here? What was done here that contributed to what you wanted to get done, to your grand scheme?
Well, a lot did get done.
Have you written that up?
I haven't written up. What there were, we had annual reports,
which
I could make available to you.
Yeah, but I mean, in your own view, as you look at what you hoped for and what you, in the end...
We had a number of doctoral theses, mm-hmm. which were very much... In fact, it's the very idea of the research organization I had would be focused on micro-entity research. There were a lot of that which were helpful.
So they contributed to what you wanted,
you
were after.
Oh, yes, and then there's people like some of the people are here, like Marlon Lee, Tongan Lee, Damon Wu. There was a whole... And Marshall Hall and Ed Greenberg, and there was a whole host of there was a big outflowing of published research, mm-hmm. which if you look at, when I look back and see at the reports that we had of the publications that came out, the papers, the books, and that there was very extensive, and much of that was very much in line with what I thought would be useful.
Mm-hmm.
And after, we also had a program in which we had one to actually implement and make go, a model which we called Muse.
Oh yes,
and we had got funds from NSF for that. That didn't succeed as well in the sense we never really got a fully running model. And the main difficulty was programming, computer. Mm. It was at the computer level. We had, I think, in terms of the rest of the elements, that to go. We had done, some of the people at this conference, we had done Alice Rivlin, who will be here, and Barbara Bergman. But Alice Rivlin and Martin Greenberger, who was our computer expert when I was at Harvard, with four graduate students at that time, or three graduate students and myself, we had done a substantial microlytic model. Mm-hmm. And a big hang-up in that was the computer thing, and it was the genius, really, of Martin Greenberger, who will be here, who was my doctoral student, but he was an applied science major. He wasn't an economic major at Harvard. And he was able to make it go on the first large-scale computer, which was IBM 704 for New England colleges, of which I was on the governing board from the Harvard end. And he was hired while a graduate student by IBM to be head of, they had 10 hours a day on that machine, and he was hired to manage their staff, which was going to use it. While he was still a graduate student. But the thing was, when we were here, we had a number of able people. We had a different machine, a 3600 CDC, Controlled Data Corporation. And there was a lot, it took a lot of, I tried to bring Martin Greenberger here. I couldn't get him here because he wasn't an economist, so I didn't have any base. Mm. The economics department offered him an assistant professorship, but MIT decided they'd rather have him. And so all I can say about that is, in terms of this grand dream, people here, some people here, Art Goldberger made a big contribution, made a contribution over the years, and has done things which I think are quite relevant. Other people, some people have. The Urban Institute, where I did go from the World Bank, we did do it. We did put what has been a successful version, which is. And so the microlytic modeling proceeded and has, in some sense, spread to Germany and Sweden and maybe Hungary now. It's never been the great success yet that I would have wanted. It may still be some point, I don't know. In our own government, it's been used successfully by a number of departments. Mm-hmm. It's never been adopted, paid much attention to in the academic profession. That's literally true. It's been in this country. I had an activity when I was at Yale, which has had some output, which related to the Urban Institute one. And so all I can say is we've had three international conferences, which relates to it, and there's a book which I've helped been one of the editors with respect to those, which I didn't organize, but which I participated in. So the idea is still going, and it's still, but in terms of here, we didn't have the muscle with respect to, let's say, implementing it in terms of computers that would have taken in those days to make it go. So I always thought that the reason we didn't wasn't because of what you had in economics here or what we had in sociology and so on. The reason we couldn't have a really good running version was because despite our big interest in it and a lot of attention to this area, I never was able to find somebody that had enough capability to replace Martin Greenberger until later.
Oh, I see. All right, just one last question. You helped build up the economics department considerably. What's your view of what's happened to it since?
I haven't followed as closely. I've been glad to see that they have a considerable strength in people like Art Goldberger and a number of people that are here, which I think are first rate. They have a good department. It's not considered nationally, I think, one of the great departments.
It was for a while, wasn't it?
I think that in terms of where our standing was, we may have moved down from the 19th to the 9th over a period. We became thought of as quite comparable with the best of the place like University of Michigan and so on. Mm-hmm. My perception is, I don't follow it, and I'm really not in a position to say, is that it is not quite that high now. I think it's a good department, but I think there has, in general, in the social sciences, I would say, I think Wisconsin did not quite keep what it was on the way to succeeding in keeping on a variety of fronts in at the early 60s.
Well, I think we better stop.
All right. Well, I hope that's something that you hope for.
Oh, I thank you very much. It's just exactly what I wanted. And I think it was very good of you to give your time to it.
I don't want to keep it.
No.